Before we get to the podcast, I wanted to make sure that you knew that my online knee course with Lenny Macrina is on sale for $200 off this week. If you want to learn exactly how to evaluate and treat the knee, you're going to love our comprehensive course where we cover our clinical examination, exercise progressions, and specific information on ACL, meniscus, patellofemoral, articular cartilage, osteoarthritis, and so much more. Plus, you can earn a ton of CEU credit. The course is on sale this week for $200 off. Head to mikereinold.com/knee for more information and to sign up today. On this episode of the Sports Physical Therapy Podcast, I'm joined by Amy Arendale. Amy is currently a physical therapist at Red Bull's Athlete Performance Center in Austria, where she specializes in working with soccer athletes. But she has an impressive resume of past experience around the world, including a stint with the Brooklyn Nets of the NBA. One of the areas that Amy specializes in is ACL injury prevention programs. In this episode, we're going to talk about her experience and her recent paper on this topic in the Journal of Orthopedic Research. Welcome to the Sports Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Reinold from MikeReinold.com. Hey, Amy, thanks so much for joining us on the podcast today. How's everything going?
Yeah, everything's good. Thanks so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an honor. You've got such a neat background that I think a lot of people are, you know, probably envious of, or maybe not. I don't know. I mean, maybe you're too nomadic, but, you know, you have such a neat background, so many great experiences. I feel like the first question we have to get to here is almost like Carmen Sandiego, but where in the world are you right now? Like, what are you up to right now?
So right now I'm in Salzburg, Austria. So I work at a Red Bull Athlete Performance Center. So we're kind of based out a little bit outside of Salzburg. So the converted barn and a converted chemical factory that you wouldn't know from the street are world-class performance center. Outside there's a chicken walking around, and inside we've got all sorts of fun stuff going on.
That's awesome. I hope you detox the area before you guys built. That would be good.
Yes, I hope so too. And I haven't dug into the story or the history of the building. The furnace is still in it, but
I like
told
that.
It's safe, and the Austrians are all about their regulations, so I'm going to go with it's probably okay.
I like that. You're going with probable, which is always a good thing in sports medicine. It's probable that they can play tonight. So I like that. But you've spent such a large part of your career working in sports, which I think is pretty cool. Obviously, a large emphasis on soccer. You know, you can tell that's your passion. And, you know, as somebody that got into the sport that they love too, you know, it's an honor, right, that we get to actually work in the sport that we grew up loving. Right. So,
yeah.
You know, so kudos to you for doing that. I mean, and getting into like soccer and staying in it professionally, because, you know, that it's hard to do. Right. So, you know, so congrats for all your hard work for that.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of ups and downs as there is at any point, I think, in anyone's career, but it's certainly, you know, it's kind of the thing that's kept me going. And a lot of times finding those opportunities, talking to the people that who have opened doors to me, you know, I'm really thankful. And, you know, whether it was volunteer or an actual paid job, you know, along the way, there's been a lot of fun. There's been a lot of soccer watching, some basketball watching, and now some not biking and skiing and you name it, along the side. But, you know, I think I've learned a lot from a lot of other sports that I've been able to bring back to soccer. And vice versa, things from soccer that I've been able to take to other sports, which has been, I think, incredibly valuable.
And I think that's a good way of putting it too. And, you know, and again, yeah, super unique. You have to work in the NBA, and, you know, it's different than soccer, right? You know, there's some similarities, but you know, it's a lot different. But again, you know, kudos to you for that. Like I've had NBA teams reach out to me for stuff in the past, and I'm like, I can't work with somebody that's 2 feet taller than me. I just can't. I don't think I could stretch out their hamstrings. Right. I don't think I could do it. So, again, amazing experience. You've put a lot of emphasis into your career on ACL injury prevention programs and some of your PhD work. Right. You had a recent article that came out with, a bunch of great co-authors in the Journal of Orthopedic Research on ACL injury prevention. And I kind of like the title. Right. The title is what really sucks you in a little bit. But it's like, where have we come from and where are we going? And I like that, the retrospect and prospective assessment of these programs, because it shows that, these are still works in progress, right? And I like that you guys, named it that way. And I gotta admit, I chuckled when I read the thing because it was great paper. but it's just like me with overhead athletes in baseball. It's very similar to Tommy John. We've put so much emphasis on injury prevention with Tommy John injuries over the years, and injuries continue to rise, right? So yeah. it's the same thing with ACLs, right? Like, we're trying so hard to prevent them, but I think just, the culture of sport just keeps evolving and pushing it, but it's just crazy. So, why don't we start with that? Like, before we even get into the prevention thing, why do you think with ACLs, why do you think we keep seeing injuries just rising year to year, in really all sports? Obviously you're field sport type, emphasis, but why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's anything, right? Everything's a we'd love to say it's this is the reason. But it's really it's a whole complex system. There's no one reason that, they continue to rise. There's no one reason that causes them. But I think, one of the things when it comes to injury prevention programs is we still have a lot of work to do. And like we talk about in the article, from an awareness and an implementation standpoint, we've done a lot of work on prevention programs. We've invented all these different programs. A lot of them look really similar. But what we haven't done is really sit down with coaches, sit down with players, sit down with parents and say, what do you guys need? What do you guys want to do? Right. Is this the problem for you? Right? Nowadays, if you were to go to, a youth soccer club and say ACL, it's a pretty household term now. Most people can at least say, okay, it's a knee injury, right? We get that far. Especially on the women's side, most women's parents would say, oh yeah, I know that's going to be a big issue. We're concerned about it. But when you actually then say, well, what do you do about it? The awareness, the knowledge isn't necessarily there. Same with on the coach's side. We haven't, as researchers and as clinicians, haven't really done the part of what do you guys need? How do we help facilitate this? How do we help implement this? What are the reasons you don't do this? If you know about it, why aren't you doing it? And so implementation is really a complex, thing to do. But I think that's a big part of where we actually are right now. We need to make prevention like brushing your teeth, right?
Right.
Your teeth is a prevention program, right? But we all do it every day. We don't really think about it. It's a nominal cost, but it's a cost we're willing to pay. And we're willing to set aside the 2 minutes in the morning and 2 minutes at the in night to do it, right?
Right, right.
If we can get injury prevention to be like brushing your teeth, golden. We're great. Then I think we'll actually start to see, some of those numbers come down. But we have to do a lot of work to get it to that point, to get it in that back of your head, I'm going to practice. I need to do this at the start and maybe this at the end. Right. And then that's just automatic. That's just habitual. Right. That's a goal. That would be great. Then I do think we start to see some actual changes. We haven't gotten anywhere close to that point yet.
Right.
I think that awareness, that education, and that implementation piece is one of the big things that we still really need to tackle when it comes to ACLs.
I think we need to take a big step back. We need to hire the PR firm that the American Dental Association hired back in the 80s, right? And I mean, think about that. They convinced us all that it's second nature that we go get our teeth cleaned twice a year, right? I mean, there's probably no research behind that. Maybe there is. I'm not speaking out of turn, right? But it's amazing. But that's common sense, right? And that's like, well, if you don't do this, there's, you know, obviously, you know, oral hygiene, but there's other health risks too. And had that took PR. That wasn't just like, you know, like a basic thing that everybody got. It got it. And we're the same way. We've done all the same things in baseball. We've had, you know, surveys of parents, surveys of coaches, right? And they're either ignorant or naive, right? It's one of the two, like, meaning like they don't believe in it. So they don't push it, or they just simply are unaware. And you could argue both are unacceptable if you're going to coach youth, right? You need to, you know, do this. So there, you know, there's tons of great programs that are starting to teach the coaches these things, but you know, it's crazy. And you know, the part I think of the article that hit me, I mean, a lot of the things in your article were very impactful comments and analyses. But I think the part that hit me was that you guys stated very clearly that we still don't know. There isn't like a magical screen we could do and say like, bingo, you do the screen. If A equals B, then you have a 10% more chance of injuring your ACL. We don't really know that yet. So it's one of those things where just performing an injury prevention program on its own, you know, is even better than going through all the hassles of trying to come up with a screen, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think there's a few pieces to that, right? If we say, okay, you know, if we take some of the frameworks around prevention, like Van Mechelen or Barr, right? They set out this framework that says, okay, if we're trying to do injury prevention, we look at the injury. How big is the injury burden, right? Okay. Once we've done that, we look at the mechanism. And we figure out what that mechanism is. What are those risk factors for it? We develop a prevention program to address that mechanism. And then we reassess, how did our prevention program do at affecting the injury burden? When we were taking ACLs, we kind of skipped that second part, right? We actually don't have really good information on the mechanism of ACL injuries. We've got all these like associations.
Right,
but we methodologically haven't done a good job at figuring out what causes ACLs.
right, for sure.
Okay, we've got association with biomechanics. We think there's associations with strength. We can go on and on with this list, but we haven't really done a solid job when it comes to scientific methods of saying, this is the mechanism. These are our risk factors.
Right.
We skipped that step and we went straight to making these prevention programs.
Right.
These prevention programs are really nice, broad, sweeping, you know, programs that kind of cover all our bases.
Like
it could be this. So we're going to all put that all into our prevention program.
Right.
So because we skip that second step, we don't have risk factors, like truly, truly scientifically rigorous risk factors.
Mm-hmm.
With that, we don't have predictive studies that are really, really rigorous. And so We don't have information that says if we intervene on this, it will lead to this.
Right.
We don't have if this happens, this may lead to an ACL. Since we don't have that, we can't say we can really well screen for risk for an ACL injury.
Right, right.
As a result, okay, we've got this nice, broad, sweeping prevention program. We know that they are effective. We don't know why they're effective. We know they're effective. So basically, we're better off just having everyone do it because we don't know why it works.
Right, right. And one component. Yeah. I mean, one component of a program probably helps this percentage of people and another component helps this percentage of people. So, but that's great, though, because when you create a broad stroke kind of program like that, that kind of hits it from all different angles. It's almost like you're covering your bases, right? And it's a good way of doing it. And, you know, and that's probably why, like, you know, you said there's some overlap between the systems. You know, there's a variety of different ones out there for sure. You know, there's the FIFA 11, or is it just 11 plus now? Did they get rid of the word FIFA from it? It's the 11 plus program.
11 plus, yeah.
Yeah. You know, there's the sports metrics one. You know, those are probably the two most common ones that I think we hear talked about the most, right? You know, like tell us a little bit about that. Like, so what are the differences between the big ones that are out there that are trying to prevent these injuries, but like, what are these buckets that they're trying to fill? Like, what are the common mechanisms that they're trying to tackle so that way we can prevent these injuries?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we look at like the meta-analyses that have been done, especially the ones that are looking at components, of these programs, right? Your big buckets are strength, plyometrics, core strength, and plus or minus balance. And I say plus or minus balance because if we're looking at, you know, the studies that go into those meta-analyses, there's some that have only used balance. And there's some that have used balance as part of their programs. The ones that have only used balance haven't necessarily been successful. So when we're looking at these meta-analyses, they're going to say, okay, balance may not need to be a component for ACL, but for knee prevention, it may be. So it's a little confusing, but where we have to then go back to is if we look at where those study, where that information comes from. So we think strength, you know, plyometrics, that core plus or minus balance are probably our big bucket. And you see that in all of these, basically all of these really successful programs. So those are kind of the check boxes that we're looking at. Same thing with the like kind of duration and the amount of time they're used. So theoretically, we're looking at, you know, 3+ times a week, 20 plus minutes each session. But that's also based on something like the 11 plus, which is supposed to take somewhere between 15 to 20 minutes, all the way to sports metrics, which takes 90 minutes 3 times a week for 6 weeks. And we're taking programs. So we've taken programs that are really different, right?
Yeah.
So 11 plus, it's that 20 minutes pre-session starting in preseason through regular season. And we're trying to compare that to sports metrics, which is 90 minutes 3 times a week for 6 weeks, and then you're
done. Right.
So we've combined programs that can be very different and smush them all together to try and say what's successful. So, you know, it's kind of tough to say, you know, for a under 11 team, 20 minutes is a long time when you have an hour practice.
That's right. You can't do that.
Your practice.
Right.
So, you know, that's where we're then needing to get creative in saying, okay, so maybe your team trains for 90 minutes. Maybe 15 minutes at the beginning can be that prevention program. Maybe some of those things, those exercises you can do at home. And we're now seeing some really good studies. For example, Matt Whalen down in Australia has done some really cool stuff about saying, well, what if we split up, say, the 11 plus? What if we do kind of some of those running-based plyometric exercises as a warm-up? And we use those kind of more strength exercises after a session or at home. We're finding pretty equal efficacy when it comes to the injury prevention, at least in kind of some of those, their smaller scale studies. But getting creative then is probably our solution to saying, okay, we're coming up with these broad-based programs. Here's our big buckets, but they don't necessarily have to be done all at once. Maybe we can get creative to help people, you know, take them up a little bit more. And that might help also then, you know, with that implementation that we talked about earlier.
Yeah, for sure. And I like the way you said that because, you know, anytime you try to do a research study, and I hate when I see these types of studies, but when you try to isolate one of those components, right, I don't think you're doing it justice because they all play off each other, right? I mean, what's the point of having power if you don't have strength? Or, you know, if you're working on balance, but you don't have strength, for example, I mean, you know, I always say like a weak muscle can't stabilize, right? So if you're just going to like functional stuff, but you have an isolated weakness of your quad, well, what's the point, right? So, you know, looking at any of those individual components by themselves is probably a disservice to answer that question appropriately. But I like the way you said it right there. As long as you, it's almost like nutrition. It's like you get your carbs, you get your fats, you get your protein. As long as you get them in over the course of the day somehow, that's probably beneficial. It's about then trying to figure out how to get it in a way that it's going to get done, right? And I think that's what you're looking for here is how do we get this to be done? Because I don't know, like, you know, I coach youth softball. I mean, you know, I'm a pretty big league, 8U, 10U, 12U, youth softball. So I have a hard time getting the girls to warm up, and I can't imagine them doing a home stretching program, right? That's not happening, right? I can't even get them to play catch, right? So like it's just to me it's such a daunting thing to do with kids. You know, I almost wonder, like, And this is where, like, how do we collaborate with the coaches to try to, like, how do we integrate a drill? So say soccer, right? A drill that's going to help them with their sport-specific skill, whatever that may be that the coach needs to work on, but also has our components together. Like, why aren't we building programs collaboratively with the coaches that work on both skill and physical at the same time? Is anybody doing that?
We'll be back after a quick break.
I hope you're enjoying the podcast episode. If you want to learn more from me, please check out my website, mikereinold.com. In addition to all my great articles, videos, and podcast episodes, I have a ton of online CEU courses, as well as my Inner Circle online mentorship and community. Be sure to subscribe to my free newsletter, where I'm always sending you great info and exclusive perks and discounts. Just head to mikereinold.com to get started. Thanks so much.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, and we'll say this because we did not set this up ahead of time. It's actually James O'Brien and I are working on a JOSBT viewpoint. So hopefully it'll be JOSBT viewpoint on this exact thing. Is
fantastic.
You know, putting the sport back in the warm-up, right?
Right.
We've come up with these, like, programs.
Yes.
But one of the things we're finding out, you know, Dustin Grooms is doing some really cool work with, like, augmented neuromuscular training. And so that for him is, you know, actually kind of a little bit on the VR side, right? So he's got athletes performing basic exercises in front of a box. That box reacts to their movements. And so they don't know anything about that box. They just know, okay, as I move differently, this box changes. Through that, like, the fundamentals of that are some just basic motor learning principles. It's an external focus. It's implicit learning, right? So even if we're taking this, you know, and extrapolating a little bit, but if we take some of those principles and we put them in a sport context, right? What's the difference of doing some of your building your sprinting, some of your bounding, some of your jumping? What's the difference of them doing those in two straight lines versus doing that in a small-sided game, right?
Exactly.
So now our athletes in that small-sided game, they're suddenly in their sport context. They're increasing that from a physiological standpoint, increasing heart rate. They're, you know, warming up. But from a cognitive standpoint, they're warming up mentally as well, and they're warming up within that sport-specific context. All of those things are valuable. All of those things are what we want to accomplish in that prevention program. So now we've got a coach that's like, oh, yeah, I know small-sided games. I can do that.
Perfect.
You know, maybe we've got four little boxes. Each has like a 3v3, right? Coach blows his whistle, you know, and yells a number, and now our players have to sprint from one box to another. So we've got change of direction within those little boxes. Maybe they've got some possession. They've got a longer sprint. You know, we can change pace. We can put little exercises within that. Maybe you blow a whistle and you've got five push-ups. Maybe you blow a whistle and you've got bridges. Maybe you blow a whistle and you've got to find another player to bump, right? So you've got to stabilize against contact. Now a coach goes, oh, I've got six exercises to integrate into a drill that I already want to do. I want to be playing soccer to build up towards soccer. I want to be, you know, catching and throwing to build up towards our softball practice, right? Suddenly that coach understands exactly what the purpose is. They're achieving some of their practice goals, and our athletes are really getting the benefit of not only the, like, sport warm-up, cognitive warm-up, and a physiological warm-up plus prevention program. That's probably the best of all worlds.
Absolutely.
That's actually one of the papers we're writing right now.
Well, and you also left out one thing, and I think I didn't appreciate this until I did get into coaching youth, you know, but you left out the biggest thing in my mind. What you just outlined right there sounded like an absolute blast. The girls love it. They would have so much fun doing those drills. That would be fun. And they love that little competing thing. They love the, you know, the teamwork of that. And it's just, it's a win-win-win right there when you do it that way. And you know, you talk a lot in your paper about implementation and compliance and those sorts of things and the differences between those, like when you start to integrate everything together, and it just makes sense. And yeah. and that is such a great way to do it. So I really look forward to seeing that. I would much rather do those types of things than like walking knee hugs, right? I mean, like, yeah. You know, like I think for the kid, it's going to keep their attention span a little bit, and it's going to be pretty good. But one thing you alluded to that I want to hear more of your thoughts on, because it's in the paper too, but the concept of internal versus external cues. And I know some of the programs do that slightly differently, right? And I, you know, there's probably something said about both of them, but you know, talk to us briefly about internal, external cues, and then maybe even like that external, like attention focus that you said all those things briefly, like in that last little segment there, but I want to learn more about those.
Yeah, definitely. So an internal cue would be something that directs your attention internally. So towards yourself. So, you know, I think that if we're thinking these, right, or we're renowned as PTs for saying, all right, we want your hips over your knees over your toes, right? Yeah, we're trying to create a nice, you know, I want you to be in a nice straight line when you're on a single leg. All that does, right, as an athlete is suddenly I'm thinking about my hip, my knee, my toe, and trying to keep them in a straight line, which that's great if we're doing this in a gym. And there's nothing else going on. I don't have to pay attention to anything else. I can stare at the ground to hold my balance. Perfect. I've mastered this exercise. If we take that and put that in a sport context, though, it's absolutely useless, right?
Right.
When our athlete is on a single leg in the middle of a game, they have visual cues. They've got auditory cues. They might have contact. The last thing we want them thinking about is their hip, their knee, and their toes.
Yeah.
We want them paying attention to all of those, that information that's coming at them at an incredibly rapid rate. We need them to be able to pay attention and filter and process and then react. We don't need them paying attention to what their knee is doing. So an external cue is purely trying to direct their attention outside of their body. So it could be a cue outside their body, or it could be a cue directed at, say, like a goal, like the goal of an exercise. So, well, if we go back to that squat, maybe we're doing a squat in front of a mirror. I'm going to put a big tape line on that mirror and say, I want you to do this squat in line with that line, right? Instead of now paying attention to what I'm doing with my body, I'm paying attention to that line.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've taken my attention from internal to external. We can also do other fun things, right? We can add a dual task. Now, dual tasking not only is your attention external, but now we're actually bringing in another motor learning principle that's called implicit learning. So the best way to describe implicit learning is to think about that athlete that knows exactly what they're going to do, what a motion is. A better example is one of the NBA players I used to work with got a question from a reporter at one point that said, how do you shoot a step back three? It sounds like a dumb question,
right?
Because his answer was, I step back and I shoot
a three.
That's all he can describe in his head. He's got this perfect movie picture. He knows internally exactly what his body does when he takes a step back three.
Right.
But to put that into words basically isn't possible.
Right.
And so that's implicit learning. You have that kind of internal knowledge, that internal movie, that internal ability to know exactly what you're supposed to do. But you can't put that necessarily into explicit knowledge, into words. There's no rules that you follow to do this movement.
Right.
And implicit learning we can facilitate with an analogy or a dual task. So simply by throwing and catching during that single leg squat, suddenly that athlete can't pay attention to what their knee's doing because they've got to throw and catch while also doing that single leg squat. And so it kind of opens up a lot of possibilities. Again, we're bringing back fun. It's a lot more fun.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, yeah. But it's also, it's almost like letting them work through it themselves a little bit, right? And I think, you know, I can't tell you how many Major League Baseball players I've seen their six-year-old sons, like, take the best swings in the world for a kid, right? Because they just try to emulate their dad, right? Same thing with PGA golfers, right? You look at Tiger and his son, like, that's been getting all the publicity lately. You know, like, Tiger didn't tell him, like, hey, I want you to rotate back on your right hip. He's just trying to do what his dad's doing, right? Yep. And it's amazing how much, you know, like, this, you know, just anytime you try to overthink something, it can just make things muddier, right? And you deal with that. But you know, this kind of reminds me, though, like, the concept of, like, blocked versus randomized practice a little bit too. Mm-hmm. Is there a benefit of starting with some internal cues for the educational process and then evolving to external cues? Or do you just think you go right to external?
So I think there's a few different thought processes, and I will admit, you know, I'm not up on the literature here. I read some of it, but there's more of it that I've not delved into. There is support for, yes, starting kind of more on the internal, building up some degree of mastery and then progressing. I think there's also thought processes and theories that actually support kind of almost throwing you in the deep end. Mm-hmm. Some of the implicit learning literature, I love it. It's hilarious because I just have a great mental picture of these, like, test participants doing it. Is, you know, what they've done is they've taken people who have never played golf, and you know, your experimental group is learning to putt. They're learning to putt, mm-hmm. but every time they hear a signal, they have to yell a number. So I just have this hilarious mental picture of people out on a putting green just yelling.
Yeah.
Right. You're the control group basically just got to learn to putt. Like, all they did was they got instructions, they learned to putt. This other group didn't get much instruction, but had to start yelling numbers while putting. Well, in the end, right, this group that just got thrown in the deep end and also had to yell numbers, not only do they end up better putters, but they're better dual taskers, and there's better transfer of that task. So not only can they actually perform that skill better because kind of they've been forced to figure it out on their own. So they're more successful in the task, but they can then also take that task and modify it. Because they've now kind of got that internal, okay, this is what I do. This is how I do it.
That's cool.
And so for me, a lot of times it depends on the athlete. I'll tailor it to the athlete. There are some athletes that really kind of struggle with something. And so, like, maybe an internal cue might help them get them going. And then I'm going to start kind of creating situations where then they kind of play a lot more. They still struggle. They still have that opportunity to figure it out for themselves. Right. Other athletes, they're better off. We just kind of throw them in the deep end. We give them something challenging, let them play with it, let them struggle with it. You do have to create kind of that safe situation for that athlete so that they know, I know I'm going to struggle with this a little bit. That's okay. In the end, that's better off.
Right. Right.
And, it also means we're going to laugh a lot more, right? Not only as a physio, it's hard for me to watch someone struggle, but a lot of times we're going to end up laughing because, you know, something funny happens. You know, I throw something and it goes in totally the wrong direction because I am inept with my hands. I can kick anything. I can't pinch anything. So we end up actually having a lot more fun, but we've created kind of that safe environment for that athlete to struggle a little bit, to play a little bit, and in the end, figure it out on their own. So I'd say, you know, I think for me clinically, it really depends on the athlete and the situation and tailoring it to what they need at that point.
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, you're unique that you probably have higher level athletes that, you know, I think what makes elite athletes elite sometimes is their ability to understand their own properception, you know, kinesthesia, you know, whatever it is, they have something different about them, right? Like, I know how to pitch a baseball better than most baseball pitchers, but I can't and they can. So it's certainly not just knowing it. But I think what makes you different, though, is that, like, if somebody is struggling with those external cues, you're an experienced enough clinician to know when to take a step back and maybe give them a couple internal cues so that way they get it. And I've seen light bulbs go off in athletes' heads. They're like, oh, that's what I'm supposed to do? I didn't even know that. But now that you tell me that, let me work on it. And then you go back to an external focus and they're doing it because they just didn't know. They didn't know that was the right movement pattern.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, for those working with younger athletes or maybe some, inexperienced people that you're not, you know, D1 athletes or pros, like, you know, that is something to keep in mind, because you go on social media and somebody's, you know, just like talking negatively about internal cues or block practice, like type things, like, yes, you know, external and randomized, those types of, yes, those are better. But sometimes people just need a little bit beforehand. So, you know, you're dealing with the best of the best. It's fun to see them progress, but I think that's a cool way of kind of putting the two together sometimes. But you're right. If you don't take that step, then they're never challenging themselves to learn and they're not going to figure it out. It's probably not going to happen. Right. So awesome. So
yeah, definitely.
Last question I wanted to talk to you about here is going back to the implementation of these things, because this is an important thing. I know a lot of sports physios, people in the States here that are trying to say, hey, I want to go work for my local soccer club or whatever, my lacrosse team, and I want to do this program. What advice do you have to give somebody in those shoes? How do you convince the coaches, the parents, the players even, you know, to do it? How do you build those into the programs? What is a great way to get started with some youth athletes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best starting point is building relationships, right? You know, and if I'm going to come in and walk in and say, all right, you need to do this, this, and this, no matter what it is, right, you're going to go, no, I'm good. Right.
Yeah. Right.
If I come in, we sit down, we have a conversation, we build a relationship, we have a bit of rapport. Suddenly, our starting point is we're doing this together rather than you should do this.
Right.
As soon as you're up, we're doing this together. Now we can start to figure out what are the reasons why it's not happening. Right. How do we overcome some of those barriers? Right. Is that knowledge and shit? They just don't know it. Is that knowledge of cost, right? Celeste Dix wrote a great paper. I think it came out 2 years ago on NCAA coaches. And for them, the number one reason why people didn't do a prevention program was cost, right? Well, that doesn't make sense. There's so many free programs. The 11 right. plus is free. You can get sports metrics through its original papers.
Right.
Even though it is a proprietary program, right? Knock control, like PEP program, all these are free. But yet cost is the thing that's being cited as the biggest barrier,
right?
So, you know, having some of those conversations and saying, this is free. Having some of those conversations and saying, hey, let's go out to the park. I can show you this. Let's run through it. You can coach me through it so you feel confident in doing it.
Right.
You know, another great example is one of the rugby prevention groups in Bath came up with this great injury prevention program, tried to implement it in a bunch of rugby clubs, came back, you know, 6 months later, however long the prevention program was, and was trying to get feedback on why people didn't do it. You know, the number one cited reason for not doing it was this prevention program had a lot of things lying down. Right. If you're in England playing rugby, it's going to be wet. Okay,
yeah.
So maybe you don't lie down in the grass for a half an hour before you then play rugby, right?
Why?
Some of these things, they might seem obvious, or they might just be, you might have totally missed it, right? But then you sit down and you're like, oh, duh, that makes sense. Well, let's figure this out. We can overcome this. I love that example, I think, because it's just, if you have this conversation, you know, some of these barriers may seem really big, and in actual fact, they may not be.
Right.
But if you're building that collaboration, if you're working with clubs, coaches, the parents, kind of all of those stakeholders, you can start to figure out where are those barriers and start to break them down more easily.
Yeah.
So just having those conversations, kind of building those relationships, I think is is probably one of your biggest starting points.
Any type of friction will slow down the process, even if it's the smallest amount of friction and the easiest hurdle to get over. So keep that in mind. It seems like it's a mountain at first, but just getting over that initial friction, like you just said with a couple of ways, I think that's a good one. I would just throw in too, from my experience with baseball, that you can go give a talk about, hey, do this exercise and you'll prevent Tommy John injuries. But, you know, most people, I think it's just like this with everything in life. They're like, that's not going to happen to me. Or I'm willing to take the risk. Like, that won't happen to me. But, the thing that we try to sell most of our programs on is for their performance enhancement capabilities as well, because it's the same program. It's the same program, right? And you may have to tell the coaches, the parents, the athletes that too. Is like, look, this is going to help you with your agility. This is going to help you with this time. This is going to help you, with your scout exposure, that type of thing. Like, there's so many things that you can come up with there, but like, you almost have to, sell it. We tell our students when they're like trying to do like some of our baseball programs in their communities, I keep saying like, look, stop trying to sell an injury prevention program. Nobody wants to buy an injury prevention program, but they will buy a performance enhancement program, right? And then make it the same thing. Just don't tell them. It's amazing, right? So, and I feel like it's the same thing here. So awesome.
Definitely.
Amy, amazing stuff. I mean, we could keep going for days, I feel like. So this was really fun. This was amazing. It was good to really connect with you. I like to end with a quick high five. So five quick questions, five quick answers, just to get to know like a little bit about the inside of your brain a little bit more. Cause I like this. It tells you a lot about people. But first question real quick is like, what are you currently reading or working on? What are you doing for your own Con Ed or professional development right now?
Yeah, so I've kind of started trying to identify who people I really admire are, and going to spend some time with them in their environment.
Cool.
Kind of really learn from them in their environment. So that's kind of my new Con Ed goal is building kind of a portfolio of people who I'm going to go and spend a few days with, learning kind of from them in their setting.
Yeah. And listeners, this is part of Amy's success that she's not telling you about here. Her network is huge, right? Because she, Like this is part of her success. That was a great one. That was a great answer. I hope people do that. Go spend some time with people that you admire. That's unbelievable. Good. All right. Number two, what's one thing that you've recently changed your mind about?
So I don't know if it's recent, but I feel like it's ever evolving is my curiosity with the brain. And learning about the brain, think as, sports or musculoskeletal PTs, I got raised as like, you're treating muscles, ligaments, bones, maybe a nerve or two, but it's like nerve is separate from musculoskeletal, and it's so not, there's so much of these motor learning principles that are basic in neuro PT, and it's like sports PT is like, oh, hey, look, this is all really new. It's not new.
Right. That's decades old. But putting it together is the way to do it.
So I think my fascination with the brain is kind of ever evolving. And so I feel like, where I can continually learn and continually change, certainly like, or I would hope improve in what I do in my practice, comes from what I'm learning about the brain, learning about motor learning, learning about attention and memory and all that kind of good stuff. So,
yeah, I feel like you're in that point in your career where you're starting to get smart, right? And you're starting to realize that the more you learn, the less we have no idea what we're talking about, right? I think that's the key. I wish everything was as simple as all the young people on Instagram are making them sound. Right. But they're just not. And you'll see that it gets there. But awesome. Yeah.
Now that just means that my research agenda is getting longer and longer and longer and longer, which is also the fun part to try and answer some of my questions. So.
Exactly. I love the energy. So keep it up. So answer those questions, too, because you're going to get tired eventually. It's going to get there. But what's your favorite piece of advice that you like to give students?
Yeah. So two things is one, go shake hands, whether that's virtually now or in person. Is go network, because the more you go and introduce yourself to the people who you're interested in or who you look up to, the bigger your network is, and you don't really get anywhere in this world without a network. And get involved, is go volunteer if you want to work in sports. Go start getting involved, whether it's volunteering or actually working. you know, all experience is valuable. And whether it's a youth team or an NBA team or anything in between, you know, all of that experience is super valuable. So network and get involved.
Awesome. And we're seeing some recurring themes here. I like that. And you know, again, the key to your success. I like that. Awesome. What's coming up next for you? Which country's next? What do you think?
In terms of living or what's actually like, what am I doing? What's next on deck?
What's coming up next for Amy in general? You tell me.
In general. So next week is the Ice Connect conference in Lyon. And then I go to the Mountain Bike World Cup in Leogang, Austria. We got a little break and then World Congress on Sports PT. And then the Argentinian Sports PT Conference. So pretty stoked for that. First time to South America.
Yeah, that'll be a fun one. That'd be amazing. Good. So awesome. And then last, if people want to learn more about you, what's the best way to find more about you?
Best way to kind of follow what I'm up to is actually on Instagram these days. So I actually recently left Twitter. So Instagram, I'm at Squeaky Edgar. And that's where, you know, whether it's courses or conferences or my own ACL rehab.
Yeah.
Or Squeaky Edgar's Adventures. Those are all on Instagram. So that's probably the best way to follow me.
Awesome. Well, fantastic. Thanks again so much for taking out time to share your experience, your vast experience with everybody. That was really beneficial. So thanks again.
Yeah, no, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcast. And please share this with your friends to help spread the word. It would really mean so much to me. Please check out all my online courses, articles, newsletter, and more at mikereynolds.com. There's always a ton of great perks for my newsletter subscribers. And also be sure to search for my other podcast, The Ask Mike Reynolds Show, where my team of physical therapists, strength coaches, and I answer your questions. See you on the next episode.